Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. You know the drill. We are Zooming on Tuesday afternoon, so if something should happen Tuesday night, I'm sure a lot will happen on Tuesday night. We'll be discussing it on Thursday. As you've come to expect, we begin our show every single day with a fabulous political limerick by Skip Tenzer. He manages to give us something that is so au courant. All right, Dave, hit it with the music.
Istanbul was Constantinople, now it's Istanbul, now Constantinople, been a long time gone, Constantinople, now it's Turkish delight on a moonlit night.
Trump finally started his own civil war. Within the party, he rotted to the core. Now his protectors, democracy rejectors, fight those with values they now abhor.
People just liked it better that way.
So take me back to Constantinople, no you can't go back to Constantinople, been a long time gone, Constantinople, why did Constantinople get the worst?
Joining us for our first guests of today are two actually old friends, and they're both from New Hampshire, so you're going to say, but Arnie, this is a national show. Trust me. Wait till you figure out why. I am reading an article that says, Corey Lewandowski is planning on running for governor in New Hampshire in 2022. And I went, oh God. And as soon as I read that headline, I knew there were two people that I knew would know a lot about Corey Lewandowski's history, a lot about his time when he was working with Donald Trump. And now, of course, what does it mean when Corey Lewandowski decides to return to his home in Windham, New Hampshire, and run for governor? Joining me right now are two people. One is currently a reporter at indepthnewhampshire.org. Gary Reno, you have been covering politics in New Hampshire for decades. So I just want my audience to get a sense of how long you've been doing this and for how many different papers you've worked for, because you really do understand the state and you've been covering it with lots of major, I think, news institutions, some sadly that don't exist anymore. But let our audience know a little bit about Gary Reno, and then I'll introduce Rick.
Well, I started covering presidential politics when I was working for the Argus Champion in Newport, New Hampshire, way back in the early 80s.
Wow.
And I've been covering it since. I was the editor of the Hillsborough Messenger for a while and had a steady, that was in 1988. We had a steady stream of candidates through the office in those days. That's when they actually stopped by and visited.
Yeah.
And then I went to Foster's Daily Democrat, where I was there for 11 years, mm-hmm. and then to the Union Leader for 16, actually. And now the last few years, I've been at InDepth New Hampshire, which is basically some former UL reporters got together and do the things that we always wanted to do and never could.
But I also want people to know that InDepthNewHampshire.org, InDepthNewHampshire.org. And that's because it's a nonprofit, and it's kind of the new model that we're now seeing happening for local journalism around the country. We see Vermont Digger, VT Digger in Vermont. You're seeing a lot of these things because local journalists basically are almost a thing of the past, but they love what they do. They know their state. They have tremendous institutional memory. And so as a result, they're creating these nonprofit models. And I'm just hoping that they succeed, because we definitely need their eyes and their ears covering what's happening in our state. Now, my other friend, you normally hear Rick Newman on our Rethink the Week, which airs on Monday. Rick is like Arnie. We've been around a long time as well. We've not necessarily been in the journalism business a la Gary Reno, but we know a lot about what's happening in politics in New Hampshire. So Rick, just share with my audience a little bit about Rick Newman.
Well, it's good to be here, Arnie. I was elected to the legislature in 1978. It seems like a long time ago, and I guess it is. And I remember when Gary came, I remember Gary being at the Union Leader, and I remember being at Foster's, which used to be a newspaper that covered Stratford County. I served off and on in the legislature, and I've been a lobbyist for the last 26 years here in the state of New Hampshire.
So let's talk a little bit about Corey Lewandowski, which is why I invited both of you gentlemen on. Corey Lewandowski became a name on the national front when he started working for Donald Trump. I remember thinking, oh my God. But of course, in some ways, it was a marriage made in heaven. Both of them are kind of bullies and both of them are kind of thugs, as far as I'm concerned. But where Corey came from was interesting. He came from a group known as Americans for Prosperity. And that's where he was running AFP in the state of New Hampshire. Americans for Prosperity is a group that's funded by the Koch brothers. I was thinking about Corey when I first really became aware of his existence. Gary, I found an article from the Union Leader, your old paper, and it was actually an op-ed by the former GOP chairman, Fergus Cullen. Fergus Cullen wrote this piece in September of 2012, right after the New Hampshire primary, because we primary very late in September, and then in anticipation of the November election. Fergus's article was entitled, "Outside Groups Are Beating the New Hampshire GOP at Picking Candidates. Who is picking New Hampshire's candidates for office?" And what he was looking at is, and many of you know, places where you gerrymander a district. The November election, especially if you partisan gerrymander, the November election has no meaning. Everything happens in the primary. And the problem with the primary is like hardly anybody shows up. And if they do show up, they're kind of the uber more conservative or more liberal of either party. He was looking at 2012 and suddenly saw all these Republicans who've been serving in the New Hampshire legislature losing their seat in the Republican primary. And he's like, how did this happen? Well, it turned out it happened in part because of Americans for Prosperity. Who is running Americans for Prosperity in New Hampshire but a guy named Corey Lewandowski? AFP, this Americans for Prosperity, targeted these state reps and these state senators because they wanted their people in. They wanted their conservatives in. One of the things that Fergus wrote about was that AFP was able to sort of target candidates in the GOP, take all this money and kind of launder it through the AFP because they didn't have to disclose the way the GOP would have to disclose. Therefore, people who might not want anyone to know if they wanted this candidate and not that candidate would run their money through Americans for Prosperity, who then would make sure that those candidates were either replaced or put in by someone else. What he basically says to the former chairman of the party, he said, candidate committees have almost become irrelevant. If you can write a larger, more substantial check, there is no reason to give it to a candidate because you'd have to disclose it. Everything you want to do, you can do through a PAC or through another entity. It makes the behind the scenes players much more influential than they ever were. And AFP is here to help. From the very beginning, he didn't like transparency. He loved money. He loved to be lethal and he loved to target the GOP. That was 2012. So let's talk a little bit about what he did since then. Gary, you cover presidential politics. Remind my audience a little bit about Corey Lewandowski and how he and Donald Trump sort of got that sort of initial marriage where they found each other in New Hampshire.
It was sort of a marriage and it sort of was a haphazard kind of way, but Corey's always found a way to sort of be where the action is, if you will. And he certainly found it with Donald Trump. And I mean, he was able to sell the Trump campaign on the fact that he was been in New Hampshire forever and had done all this and that and hooked on and was basically the campaign manager until the Trump family decided that they thought he ought to go. And that was later in the campaign. Corey had been around New Hampshire politics for quite a while. I first encountered Corey when he was working for Bob Smith, Senator Bob Smith.
Right.
Soon after that, he started working for the Americans for Prosperity, and where he's had a pretty good run for quite a while before he jumped into working for the Trump campaign.
So, Rick, Corey Lewandowski has sort of been in and out of the Trump orbit for the last 4 years. He's embraced, and then he's fired, and then he disappears, and then he comes back. I think Donald Trump saw an alter ego with Corey Lewandowski. They're both soulless. They both don't necessarily value the facts. Honesty is expendable with both of them. So what I think has always been so interesting about Corey is that Donald Trump never really let go of him. The family may have fired him, but Corey always managed to create an incredible relationship with Donald Trump. And you actually see that relationship even until the very end, where I think he just put him on some sort of a Pentagon board just in December. When you think of Corey, you don't think of Lewandowski, you think of Donald Trump.
He certainly has become you know, one of those people identified with Trump in the last 4 years. All reports are that he's done very well financially, never registered as a lobbyist, but is known as one of those people that he's got Trump's cell phone number, has been essentially, you know, selling access to government for the last 4 years, and doing it in a manner that doesn't require any disclosure, at least they think it doesn't. One of the most intriguing things to me about his whole run, there's a lot of things that are intriguing, but, you know, one of them is that while testifying to Congress, you know, he made a statement that I just thought I'd never really hear someone say, where he said to Congress under oath, "I have no obligation to tell you the truth."
Yeah.
He was being asked questions about what he had done during some aspect of the Trump scandal that was going on, where he lied to the press. And he said, "I'm under no obligation to tell the truth." If someone said that 20 years ago to a congressional committee, the idea that they could even be thought of as a candidate for statewide office anywhere would be absurd. But we live in a different time now. And, you know, we live in a different political environment, particularly on that side of the aisle.
Gary, didn't he actually talk about running for the United States Senate against Jeanne Shaheen for a while? And then, you know, I think started even doing some fundraising for that. And then all of a sudden, I think maybe, you know, a couple of months later, he decided he wasn't going to run against Jeanne, but if he had run, he would have beaten her, is what he said. He's floated these ideas of coming back and sort of exercising some sort of political muscle. I'm just wondering if he's all hat. It's all talk. There's nothing there. So we've seen this do it this time with Jeanne Shaheen, but this run for governor seems like there's a little more potential for him to actually follow through on the threat of running for governor in 2022.
Well, I think what we're seeing is this dichotomy in the Republican Party right now between the Trump forces and the old Republican Party in New Hampshire. He was playing into that when he was talking about running for U.S. Senate. I think he, like a lot of people, probably saw the polling and thought that, no, I'm not going to beat Shaheen no matter what I do, so I'm not going to do that. I mean, if you remember, even Chris Sununu was making noise about running for U.S. Senate against Shaheen and then decided that that wasn't a good idea. And then again, we have this upcoming election where everybody expects that the governor is probably going to run for U.S. Senate against Maggie Hassan, and that Kelly Ayotte is interested in becoming the Republican candidate for governor. I'm sure that Corey's sitting down there in Washington thinking, I bet I can raise an awful lot of money. I can make a big impact. Besides, Kelly's old school. She's not a big backer of us. So why not go in there? The primary, and anything can happen, and it's not necessarily going to be good for Corey.
Well, let me just say something, Rick, but it may not be good for Corey, but the Republican Party has been hollowed out. We know that it's been hollowed out, that those old sort of moderate, regular Republicans, Kelly Ayotte really comes from that family of Republicans. I'm not sure they exist anymore, even in New Hampshire. Chris Sununu tried to be like a mugwump and play the old party, old Republicans and the new Republicans. When you look at what got elected in this recent election, the Republicans took over the House and Senate. They actually beat the Democrats. But you look at what happened during like the swearing in, or you look at some of the first meetings of the Republicans, and you see 80 maskless Republicans. You see the Speaker of the House die of COVID. I am just wondering if Corey's being really smart here, because while Kelly Ayotte may have more of a history with the Republican Party, the Republican Party that exists today is the Trump Party, not the Republican GOP.
My take is he's being very smart because he's looked at Donald Trump. Trump has raised $350 million.
Exactly.
Okay. Yeah. From donors for what exactly? I can't understand why people are contributing to him. But I'm not talking about raising $3 million. I'm talking about raising $350 million to the point where he's got a fundraising letter out today asking people to contribute money to him to help in the Georgia election, which is over in 2.5 hours. That money, of course, will end up going into some PAC. We've got a Federal Election Commission that pretty much doesn't exist anymore. It doesn't do anything. By the time anybody gets around to auditing whatever happened to that $350 million, my grandchildren, if I ever have any, will be dead. When I say smart, I'm saying, look, if you're looking over the fence right now and it's January of 2021, you throw out there, I'm going to run for governor, and you've got the Trump mailing list, you could probably raise yourself $50-60 million, and then you don't run.
Gary, the other reason why I think Corey is really smart here, and I think if he decides to run, Kelly's trashed, and here's why. The reason he's going to be running is in anticipation of Donald Trump running in 2024. Last time I looked, who was the first in the nation presidential primary? The state of New Hampshire. What do we know about presidential politics? And Gary, you and I both know this, and so does Rick. When the November election ends of 2020, already candidates who are thinking of running in 2024 are already hiring people so that they'll be on the ground in case New Hampshire still retains its first in the nation presidential primary, because they want to make sure that they have a welcome mat when they show up here. Corey Lewandowski will have a national fundraising appeal, because even if there's only 14 people in New Hampshire that may want Corey Lewandowski to be the governor, there are 14 million people around the United States that want Donald Trump to run again, if not, you know, 50 million. And he can say to them, then you want me to be the governor in New Hampshire because I will welcome our Donald. I mean, doesn't that make sense to you? I mean, Rick thinks he may not run and just pocket the cash. I think he'll run, and I think he'll just make sure he raises the cash, and he'll blow everyone away, because they're literally, they've never seen a campaign with so many checks with commas in them pouring into a campaign coffer. Doesn't that make sense to you, Gary?
Oh, it makes perfect sense. But I mean, you talk about checks with the commas. I was just thinking of Craig Benson running for governor, but you know, he poured a ton of money into that campaign and he won.
He did win. But the problem is going to be, let's be honest here, the Republican Party may have voted for Kelly Ayotte before, but they tend to be somewhat of a sexist party. If Donald Trump has hollowed out the GOP, Trump does not like John McCain. What do we know, Rick, about Kelly Ayotte and John McCain? Weren't they the three amigos? Like McCain and what's his face from South Carolina and Kelly Ayotte. This is a really smart move on the part of Corey, and it brings all the Trump baggage into the state of New Hampshire, because that's what he's going to build his campaign on.
I'm not giving up my idea that this is just a ploy to raise money, because I wouldn't be surprised if it is. But even if there is a campaign, I think one thing we've seen in the last couple of years, and really, if you think about it, we've seen it for decades. Remember John Connally back in 1980 running for president? He spent $1 million. $1 million in 1980 was like $200 million now. And Connally got one delegate to the convention. He was one of the best funded candidates. But more recently, we've seen people spend a lot of it. Look at the money spent on a Senate race. Jamie Harrison in South Carolina, he just spent over $100 million. And he lost. The woman up in Maine, Gideon, she left the campaign with $4 million in the bank. And she got beat by, because she spent so much, she couldn't spend anymore. And so he can have a lot of money. But, you know, don't discount a Kelly Ayotte, former U.S. Senator, former Attorney General, and an appeal. And we also have to keep in mind, we don't know what's going to unravel in Trump world in the next 2 years when you don't have an Attorney General of the United States protecting you from subpoenas for records and all these other things that are coming down. I mean, so, and the final thing is, Gary mentioned, yes, Craig Benson won in New Hampshire spending a lot of money, but he won in one of those rare times, and no offense to you, Arnie, but the Democratic nominee that year was supporting an income tax, and it's not likely the Democrats are going to nominate that person again or a person like it, so it would not be a shoo-in.
Corey is almost, he's so identified with Donald Trump, he's more like a son than he is like a campaign operative. I mean, the two of them are like, one breathes in, the other one breathes out. And I agree with you. We don't know what the political landscape is going to look like for a year and a half. Gary, what follows Trump isn't about right or wrong. It isn't about good or bad. It isn't about up or down. It is a cult of personality. And they are willing to write check after check after check. And they also go into their own little zone. It's not going to be Fox anymore. It's going to be Newsmax and Parler and whatever else. Guess who's going to be there too? Corey Lewandowski. Corey doesn't care whether the money comes in from New Hampshire. He just cares if the money comes in. And guess what? When you are following the cult of Trump and you were assumed to be the son of Trump, then I think he has a real opportunity to do something Craig Benson couldn't do or all those self-funded candidates couldn't do, is that he really does say, I'm going to deliver Trump to New Hampshire in anticipation of 2024. You want me as the governor, and I can deliver for Donald.
It's just one problem with that, though, Arnie.
Okay. Excuse me. Please, please.
Trump hasn't won New Hampshire in the general election yet. He has won in the primary, but he has yet to win in the general election in New Hampshire.
Right. Right.
And he lost this time by 50,000 plus votes.
So we're talking about 50,000 votes, but we're also talking about a primary. Okay. Donald Trump won the primary. It was the first primary he won. He was so excited. He won the primary in New Hampshire. And now you're looking at him, at Cory going into the primary. At this point in time, does Cory want to win the general election? I'm not sure he gives a crap. I think what he wants to do, however, is basically say to Donald Trump, I'm going to make sure that the Republican Party in New Hampshire is something you continue to own, and I'm going to be able to prove it. And whether he becomes the governor or not, his running basically sort of reinforces the idea that this is not the GOP, this is the Trump Party. Do you think the success is becoming governor or the success is controlling the GOP?
Well, I think going forward, the success is controlling the GOP for the Trump organization. Yep. That's what they want to do. And they've put a lot of time and effort into that. The New Hampshire GOP at this point is the top echelon of it is certainly beholden to the Trump campaign and the Trump team. And I don't think that's going to change even in 2 years. I mean, that's probably going to be still in place. So, I mean, it's not whether Cory runs or not, that's probably going to be the case.
And I would also point out that despite the natural tendency for all of us in politics to think, well, Governor Sununu is going to take the logical next step and run for the U.S. Senate, I'm not certain that that's a done deal. I'm not certain he doesn't seek a fourth term for governor. I'm not certain he doesn't just go back to the private sector. Or yes, he could certainly run for the Senate. It just seems to me that some of the things he's said about why in the world would you want to get involved in that mess down there in Washington? You know, I have a feeling he might be sincere about that. You know, he's got a young family. It's not the best place in the world to raise kids.
Well, let me just say something, Gary. It turns out that maybe where the governor lives now is not such a great place to raise kids because he asked for a mask mandate now because he's like shutting down some businesses because now he's finally catching up to the rest of the New England governors who all did all those behaviors to protect their population from the spread of COVID. Remind my national audience what's happening in New Hampshire. It turns out that the anti-maskers are now going to his home and they are actually picketing outside of his house. He's suggesting that they're even threatening with guns, although they claim they're not. And this is an open carry state. All of a sudden, the governor is terrified by the kind of behavior he's seeing because while that behavior was happening, you know, a la Trump and maybe in other places around the country, it's now happening to the Republican governor in New Hampshire because we've actually encouraged this kind of behavior, Gary. What's safe for anyone, anywhere, given what Trump has encouraged?
Politics, like we've never seen it as aggressive in New Hampshire. We've never seen this sort of thing. We never saw the armed protesters like we saw this summer and so on. I mean, it's really gotten, it's been turned up a huge notch. It's not good old New Hampshire anymore. That's for sure.
But it's not good old anywhere anymore. And we're going to be talking with a former Secretary of State in our second half of the show. And I keep thinking about these people who, you know, they run for the legislature or they run for Secretary of State or they run for Attorney General, never thinking that they were putting their life on the line. And now, because of what's happened with Donald Trump, all those positions, you now suddenly feel so incredibly vulnerable. What the governor is now experiencing with people picketing him, and it's an open carry state, and you can carry a concealed weapon without a permit in New Hampshire. He's so upset about that. But Rick, let's remind everyone, you can carry a weapon onto the floor of the state house. You know, you can't carry a sign onto the floor, but you can carry a weapon onto the floor of the state house. So it's ironic he's so concerned now because it's shown up on his sidewalk outside of his house. Well, I think a lot of us would be concerned because it can show up in our state legislature, Rick.
It's like anything at other time in history, right? I mean, a very loud, small group of people can get a lot of attention. When we talk about the people protesting outside the governor's house, which I personally find offensive as well, but you're talking about, I think the last time there were 12 people there. It wasn't a million man march. It wasn't 50,000 people. You got 12 or 13 people show up and yell with bullhorns and break the law and step on someone's lawn and do things, they get their name in the paper. Rennie Cushing was the current leader of the Democrats at the New Hampshire House. You know, he had 10,000 people with him when he was demonstrating against the Seabrook nuclear power plant in the 1970s. They had a crowd. These guys are a bunch of people taking a walk.
On that note, they are, but the crowd with Rennie Cushing when he was fighting Seabrook, they didn't come with their ammunition. They didn't come with their weapons. They didn't have loaded guns. And I know it's only 12, but let's remember, on a number of occasions in the New Hampshire legislature, in the middle of a hearing, someone drops a weapon during an abortion hearing. And you have to think, was that intentional or not? So you don't need a lot of people. You just need one gun. I'm just going to remind you. Thank you, gentlemen. Gary Rano currently writes for In Depth New Hampshire. He's been covering New Hampshire politics for decades. Rick Newman is a former state rep, and he's also currently a lobbyist. We're going to be covering Corey Lewandowski if he decides to run for governor. And we'll have to see how often Donald Trump comes to help campaign with him. Oh, I can't wait. Stick around, everyone. This is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We'll be right back.
Insight Daily Radio. Conversations with today's most influential authors, actors, musicians, artists, and creative minds. For over four decades, the manual for job hunters and career changers has been the bestseller, What Color is Your Parachute? The author is Dick Bowles.
Overall, I think it's harder to be a job hunter today because of what I call expectations. That is to say, in the old days, you knew you had to work hard at the job hunt. Now, people fall asleep at the switch because their expectation is they won't have to work that hard at it because the internet will make it all happen without their doing so much as raising a little finger. They did a survey, I think back in 2009, but I have no reason to think it's changed. They found out that when they interviewed college grads who couldn't find work immediately and went back to live with their parents, they asked them, how much time on average are you spending on your job hunt? And the answer was, on average, they were spending 1 hour a week on their job hunt. I couldn't find a lost dog in 1 hour. And yet that's all the time they thought they needed to devote to it because they thought in this new age with the internet and everything, the jobs will essentially walk up to my front door and ring the doorbell. So the expectation corrupts the amount of energy and time that they're willing to devote to the job hunt. The job hunt is always about energy, time, and commitment. And with the current era in which we now live, they're running against the culture when they're trying to run a successful job hunt now. And that did not used to be the case. You knew you had to work hard at it.
Dick Bowles, author of the bestseller, What Color is Your Parachute? There's more online, insightdailyradio.org.
Black nights, do I do that?
Welcome back to part two of the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Another reminder that we're Zooming on Tuesday afternoon. I've been thinking a lot about this hour and 5 minute call to the Georgia Secretary of State. I've been thinking a lot about the election that is taking place today, Tuesday, the day that we Zoom in Georgia, and how so much is on the line by who wins this election, which seems so unfair. But yet that's the reality of what's happened right now with such a divided nation. I'm thinking about what's happening January 6th, when they're just supposed to certify the vote that's coming out of the Electoral College. And this is like a pro forma, usually takes about 20 minutes. But instead, we see 13 U.S. senators and 140 House members that are basically going to challenge the results of the Electoral College. I'm looking at how does Joe Biden run a country that is not only so divided, but is suffering from a pandemic and an economic downturn, and also fear of violence. That's the other piece that I think we have to throw in here. And then I'm thinking about all the elected officials who also feel threatened. They decided to run for attorney general, or they decided to run for secretary of state, and they didn't realize that people would be threatening their families and that they'd be having armed guards around their house. And all they were doing was overseeing an election. So as I was thinking of all this, I realized there was one person who could probably speak to so many of this. Miles Rappaport was the former Secretary of State of Connecticut. He was the president of Demos and as well as Common Cause. He is now with the Ash Center at Harvard. You've worn all these hats, but you start out as Secretary of State, which is how I got to know Miles Rappaport, and even before that, Miles. So as you're looking at the chaos that we are living, and you've spent your entire life trying to sort of embrace democratic institutions, make them healthy, make them transparent, make sure that people have the right to exercise the franchise, want to make sure that there is accuracy in the vote, all those things that you've devoted your life to, and frankly, I've devoted my life to. And I feel like everything we've worked for is sort of dissolving in front of our eyes, because Donald Trump has challenged every institution. And while they've held, they've been so harmed by the actions of the last 4 years.
Arnie, thank you for having me, first of all. And it's good to be with someone who I've been working for our democracy for so many years. Well, I think you're right in a significant way. I do think that it is absolutely extraordinary, stunning, horrifying what Donald Trump and his supporters in the Republican Party, not all of the Republican Party, but his supporters, are attempting to do to our democracy just so that he can stay in office and have the perquisites of office. I mean, the level of norms that have been broken, the level of misinformation, disinformation, outright lies, pressure tactics that he has brought to bear on the situation are really amazing. I think even a couple of years ago, people would not have predicted it, although I think many people have really learned, just when you think you've seen it all from Donald Trump, there's more. Yeah. Now, on the other hand, where I'm not as pessimistic as, you know, some people are, is that I do think that the democratic institutions tested, had an incredible stress test in 2020, which is continuing, but they held, not by much, but they did hold. What you saw was some incredibly brave, I think, Republican secretaries of state, including the Secretary of State of Georgia, the Republican election officials in Wisconsin, who stood up to Trump and declared the election for him, Michigan as well. There's been an incredible and terrible fissure created by Trump and people like Corey Lewandowski, who have been his enablers and hangers-on for years in our politics, and I think in the Republican Party as well. But I want to applaud the election officials who stuck through this all. I want to applaud the judges, including some that were named by Donald Trump, who have simply rejected every single far-fetched thing that he's thrown at them and done so consistently under great pressure, who actually turned out to vote. And yes, 74 million people voted for Donald Trump, but 81 million people voted for Joe Biden.
The reason that happened, ironically, is not just because it was Joe versus Donald. It was because of the pandemic. And let's remember what the pandemic allowed us to do, something we had historically never been able to do. Because of the fear of COVID and that it was so contagious, you saw states do things they had never done before. I'll go to Texas first. The governor of Texas expanded early voting by a week so that people didn't have to necessarily have 2 weeks. They could have 3 weeks of early voting. In my state, where we had absentee voting, normally you had to say you were going to be out of state or you were ill or whatever. And basically now you could just say fear of COVID. Okay. And you could do absentee voting. That was something we had never allowed before.
Right.
So all of a sudden, it became easy for people to do mail-in voting, absentee voting, early voting, all those things that people like you and I have always wanted. We've always wanted to make it easier for people to vote, right, not harder for people to vote. So what you've got is a combination of an incredibly horrific human being named Donald Trump running against kind of a nice schlub named Joe Biden. You know, I mean, it's not like he was this vibrant, passionate person that you would want to like break down walls for. But then you have a pandemic on top of that, which really made everyone sort of aware of how fragile we all are, both economically and from a health perspective. Plus, Donald Trump was obviously almost undermining our ability to stabilize our health and stabilize our economy. And so because we made voting easier to do, yep, look who took advantage of it. It's proven our point. It's not that people don't want to vote, but people don't want to wait online for 8 hours when they have a job. They can't wait online for 10 hours when they have a kid. They can't get time off for work. And what you see is that this elastic way of voting is actually a good thing for the franchise because people are willing and interested in participating, but they have felt that they couldn't make the Sophie's choice, my job or a vote.
Well, I think it's going to be very interesting whether 20 or 25 states who made changes to make it more possible to vote. And in Connecticut, where I'm from, the same thing happened with the governor. The governor announced that fear of COVID was a legitimate health reason for not voting, for voting absentee, rather. People took advantage of it in great numbers. Are the states going to make those things permanent? Because you're absolutely right, Arnie, that when you give people more options to vote, when you make it more possible, they will vote. That's shown. And there's no reason why the kinds of expansion of mail-in voting and the kind of expansion of early voting and the 24-hour drive-through voting, which the county clerk of Houston initiated, why those can't be made permanent. So I think one of the things that we will see in state legislative sessions, which are themselves going to be all messed up this year because of COVID, is whether those things will be made permanent and whether those advances will continue. Or will states say, well, we want to go backwards. We want to make it harder again, which I think will happen in some states. We'll have those fault lines of battle going forward as we have had them in the past around voting.
We are going to have them even more because the tragedy of this election of 2020 was when you looked at what happened, Joe Biden did win. There's no question about that. And he will be seated on January 20th. It would be President Biden. But then let's look at what happened in the House of Representatives. Nancy Pelosi has a very thin majority. She didn't get a huge number of new members of Congress. In fact, she got fewer Democrats. Right. Then let's look what's going on in the United States Senate. We're all on pins and needles because, you know, we're Zooming on Tuesday and we don't know what the heck is going to happen in Georgia. And we probably won't know for a couple of days. And even if we do know, Miles, you know, there's going to be a recount and a recount and a recount because the numbers are going to be so close no matter what happens. So Georgia is going to be an interesting race. But what we absolutely lost was that we lost what happened at the state level. And so state legislatures around the country did not flip. And the Republicans had controlled more state legislatures before the 2020 election. And here's the irony. Only two state houses in the entire country changed. And it was in my state where the House and Senate were controlled by Democrats, and they now are controlled by Republicans. We already know that the Republicans saw that all this sort of expansion of voting, you know, absentee and mail-in and early voting, what did that mean? It meant that Donald Trump lost, and it meant that more people exercised the franchise. Trust me, if they're in control, not only are they going to do some wicked partisan gerrymandering in the next 2 years, which is going to make us miserable for a decade, but they are going to make sure that not only roll back what they did for the pandemic, but I think they're going to make it even harder for people to exercise the franchise because they want to pick their voters. They don't want the voters to pick their politicians.
One of the worst things that happened after the 2010 Tea Party wave was the partisan gerrymandering that took place and the restrictions on voting, voter ID, photo ID, proof of citizenship laws that were undertaken by a number of states under new Republican control or new trifecta Republican control. I will say one interesting thing, which is that people around the gerrymandering redistricting issue have fought back over the last 10 years. Yes. And in places like, well, California always had it, but in places like Ohio and Pennsylvania and Michigan, and even places like Missouri, there have been changes made which will make it a much less partisan redistricting come 2021, even though those legislative houses didn't flip to Democrats. In some of those states, there's a Democratic governor who has some impact on it. So I'm a little more optimistic about what the gerrymandering will do, but I am deeply concerned about the mistrust of government, mistrust of elections, mistrust of public officials that has been bred and fomented by the Trump wing of the Republican Party.
So Miles, as we were going on the air, I was looking at my Twitter feed and I saw a tweet coming out of Pennsylvania. And the tweet coming out of Pennsylvania was that the lieutenant governor was basically sort of holding court in the Pennsylvania State Senate, which is controlled by Republicans, okay? He was about to recognize a Democratic state senator who had won the election. The Republican-controlled state Senate removed the lieutenant governor from chairing, and they were denying the Democrat who had been elected his seat in the Republican-controlled state Senate. This is not about Donald Trump. As someone wrote, the Civil War has begun. So you are now seeing the poison that Donald Trump has really sort of wrought. The poison that we're going to see happening tomorrow, January 6th, with the 13 senators and the 140 House members that are going to basically try to somehow create this idea that Joe Biden did not receive the vote, and they're going to somehow say that those states, Pennsylvania, Arizona, Georgia, those states are illegitimate, and therefore Donald Trump really is the president. You're seeing that at the national level. But in Pennsylvania, look what they did today. Today in Pennsylvania, they refused to recognize a Democratic senator who won the vote. And that's what's so scary. Part of me thinks that the craziness is all going to be happening in Washington, but now you're seeing it crop up and be replicated in Republican-controlled houses and senates around the country. And that, to me, is where it gets really terrifying. That's where you're looking at it going, now, how do we address that? We know Joe Biden is going to be seated, but when you see this kind of thing happening here, the distrust that you were so worried about, well, now I think it's just become exponentially more distrustful.
I was astonished is a word that we throw around too much these days, but I certainly was disappointed, maybe not as surprised as I should have been, at the Republicans who have countenanced, encouraged Trump's absolutely untrue challenge of the election. So the 100-some-odd members of the House, we'll see how many it is, who are supporting the challenge to the electors tomorrow, the 13 senators who at one level or another are going to support it. And I think the thousands of people that Donald Trump is bringing into the streets of Washington tomorrow. I am concerned that we will see an increased level of political violence in the country that is not going to be easily contained. I do think that these are going to be real issues of law enforcement and of order control for public officials, Democrat or Republican, either way. So I think we're in for a tough period. I am glad that the election will hold as it was conducted and that this kind of totally false crusade, lost cause crusade, you might say, that Trump has engaged in is not going to work. But it certainly prefigures some really, really hard times ahead. You're right.
So Miles, let's remind everyone, the 140 members of the House don't think that Joe Biden didn't win. The 13 members of the United States Senate don't think that Joe Biden didn't win. What they do know is that their base does. And they do know that their primary voters do. And especially for the 140 members of the House, they run every 2 years. You know, some of those U.S. senators, they may have just gotten reelected, and they may have 4 or 6 years, or they may be thinking of running for president. But those House members, it's not about whether Biden won or lost. It's about the fact that they're pandering to their primary base, because they know that they could so easily lose in a primary if Donald Trump goes after them. So they have to sort of cultivate that Trump GOP, because that's how they guarantee themselves that they're going to win their primary, and therefore it's a slam dunk for the general election. I mean, I keep telling my audience, the QAnon congresswoman, all right, who just got sworn in, the one who, by the way, had a mask on when she got sworn in that said Trump won. And then as they were about to swear her in, she took her mask off and people went berserk because she was in the chamber with her mask off and she was literally fighting with people because she didn't want to wear a mask during the time of a even more contagious COVID. That's part of the problem is that they are not captured by the facts. They're not captured by the truth. They're not even captured by Trump, but they are captured by Trump's base that will define whether they win their primary or not. Because that woman, that QAnon congresswoman, when you look at how many votes she actually got to become a congressperson, she only got 6% of the vote in her state. 6%. Because that's all that it took for her to win her primary because nobody showed up. And now she's a sitting member of Congress. That is the story that we don't quite understand. How could they be buying this lie? They're not buying the lie. They're buying the fear.
Well, I think one very interesting thing to watch over the next 2 years, let's say, and 4 years, certainly, is what happens to the Republican Party. Does the vote tomorrow become a fault line? Because you have seen some pretty conservative senators say, I'm not going along with this, really for the first time. And of course, they overrode Trump's veto on the defense authorization bill. So are you going to see a real split in the Republican Party between people who are willing to just take whatever Donald Trump serves up and go with it? Or is there going to be some movement within the party or to leave the party by people who are not ready to go along? I think what Trump has done with this call to the Secretary of State of Georgia and what he's done around this crusade, once he's out of office, he may not have the power and sway that everyone assumes that he has. That'll be interesting to watch. I can't predict it. It's not my party. But I think that's it's actually going to be a really, really interesting dynamic. And it's too early, in my mind, it's too early to predict, but we should watch it. Is it Donald Trump and Corey Lewandowski's party, or are there other people who are going to come to the fore and say, no, not so fast?
What I think is, again, fascinating is the fact that Donald Trump did get 74 million votes. That's just mind-blowing. That's after 4 years of living with Donald Trump. I mean, I could sort of understand what he did in 2016. I really kind of. You know, I mean, he played the populist card. Nobody liked Hillary anyway. What are the numbers from Pew? Pew said the most disliked presidential candidate ever in American history was Donald Trump. The second most disliked presidential candidate in American history was Hillary Clinton. So it was kind of like, ugh, and ugh. A lot of people, they knew they didn't like Donald Trump, but they figured, I didn't like Hillary either. They have a distaste for the Clintons, or they may have a distaste for politicians per se, and Donald played the outside card. So why not try the businessman outside card? After all, he was a billionaire, he told them. What is more shocking is to see the vote he got just recently. That to me is something that no Republican has ever had that cultish following ever. And you talk about a schism within the Republican Party. And what I'm frightened about is that that schism looks real on paper, but when it translates down to voters and people, I don't think it's much of a schism. I think it's a group of intellectually elite, maybe the more sort of economically sophisticated, whatever, but the angry white conservative, somewhat, you know, anti-immigrant base, they're not going to leave him, because those other Republicans that you're talking about, what can they offer them? What leadership can they offer them? They believe in a sort of vibrant immigration policy. They believe that they should have, you know, trade pacts with countries around the world. When you look at what they believe and you look at what Donald Trump has sold, the vast majority of Republicans that followed Donald Trump, they don't like that Republican Party, because Donald Trump actually ran against that Republican Party as much as he ran against the Democrats.
I think all those are right on target. We'll see. I do think that a lot of it was, he's our president. He's our guy. He's the tough guy. He's the sheriff in town. What if he's no longer the sheriff? What if he's indicted in New York State for tax fraud? His tweets aren't going to get covered by the mainstream media the way they've had to during his presidency. So we'll see. Here's the one thing I want to make sure that we do, though. I think it's really important, not for us, for people who care about democracy, who care about actually making sure that we have a government that represents and is responsive to the people, not to give up on it, not to say, well, if democracy is producing 74 million votes for Donald Trump, then what the heck? No, I believe firmly that it is important to contest the terrain. It is important for people to go. And I'm in favor, as you know, we spoke about this on another program, of actually requiring every citizen to vote. Because I think if we had 90% of the people voting instead of 50 or 60% of the people voting, everybody was going to turn out. People would have to talk to the entire electorate. So I think we should continue our forward motion towards the democracy that we want to have. We're going to have to do battles with the people who want to undo democracy, with the people who want to distort it, with the people who want to live in an alternate universe of lies and bigotry. You know, that is where we are right now. But I think we've got to stick with our belief that a full and functioning democracy is within reach, and we should keep fighting for it. That's my feeling today. With a new president, a new Congress, maybe we can start to make some real progress.
I've been thinking a lot about the fact that they're having such a difficult time with the vaccine. The rollout has been so awful, and people are terrified. I mean, they're terrified because they now find out there's a new form of COVID, and it's more contagious, and it has an impact on their business. And I mean, just the food lines, the whole thing. I do think that in reality, because this is so lethal and so deadly, that if Joe Biden can show America again what good government looks like, what effective government looks like, what happens when he sends in the National Guard or he sends in whatever, and they're able to get shots in the arm and they're able to sort of restore some kind of economic stability. And he does something that Donald Trump does. And what Joe Biden needs to do is take credit for all of it. Every time everything good happens, it's because Joe was there. Part of the problem is that sometimes when government does things well, it becomes almost invisible. It becomes an assumption that we're supposed to have this. I think what we have to do is claim ownership of this. And I've always told the story that when I was running for Congress in 1996, I went down to an event in Massachusetts, and I can't remember the name of the congressman, but he was an old congressman from Massachusetts, and he'd been there for 30 years. He spoke just before I spoke. Now, remember, I'm from New Hampshire, where we're kind of like, we don't like big government, we don't like big church, we're kind of libertarian. So I never really had the experience of a Massachusetts Paul. I watched him in front of 5,000 people in this room, and he stood up there, and he said to them, "See that bridge? I brought you that bridge. See that building? I brought you that building." And he kept pointing to all these like infrastructure things and health policy things. And he took credit for it. I'm watching them almost standing on their chairs applauding because he was right. It wasn't just like he alone, but it was government doing something positive that had a positive consequence for everyone sitting in that room. You know, whether it was a repair of that highway or whether it was that new facility at the college or whatever. But he reminded them that there was a connection to what was good in their life, to what government did. I have never forgotten that. It is so rare that I see Democrats not do that. And I remember how they poo-pooed Donald Trump when he wanted to sign all those checks that they were sending back in the relief bill and everybody was rolling their eyes. And I'm thinking, no, sweetheart, that was brilliant. Not that I want Joe Biden to become this sort of self-loving Donald Trump. I do think I want him to be able to say, this is why it worked, because government worked for you. Miles Rappaport, former Secretary of State of Connecticut, former president of Demos, former president of Common Cause, now with the Ash Center at Harvard. Thank you so much. And I do think that we should mandate voting. I think it's a great idea, you know. Ciao, Miles.
All right. Bye, Arnie. Thank you.
You're welcome. This is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson, producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We'll schmooze tomorrow. Ciao. You bet.